Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. John Angelopoulos is one of Forbes magazine's 50 most powerful women in the world, and she was also the president of the 2004 Summer Olympics bidding and organizing committee. Ahead on Only a Game, Angelopoulos looks back on the Olympics she helped bring to Athens. Also, Berkshire Hathaway stockholders rally around billionaire Warren Buffett with a weekend of running and junk food.
Obviously, he's very successful, and he's come this far, and even, you know, snacking on peanut brittle and drinking Diet Cokes, you know, all day today. I mean, he's really plugging along.
Also ahead, the Senators blocked the Canadiens' passage to the second round of the NHL playoffs, and Oklahoma City point guard Russell Westbrook finds peace and contentment on the injured list. Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game is provided by Oliver Wyman. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The NBA postseason grinds on, and much of the basketball world has focused on the Game 2 revenge of the LeBrons, Golden State sharpshooter Stephen Curry, and the Knicks' first playoff series win in 13 years. But there's also a dandy second-round series unfolding between the Oklahoma City Thunder and the Memphis Grizzlies. The Thunder are without the services of all-star point guard Russell Westbrook. Joining me now is Daily Oklahoman columnist Barry Trammell. Barry, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Westbrook has been very important to the Thunder's recent success. He was injured at the end of last month. He underwent knee surgery back on April 27th. But so far, the team has managed to be very competitive in the postseason without him. How have they managed to do that?
Well, I mean, they've got Kevin Durant, and that's a great place to start. But they've also built a really solid team, a really good defensive team, some solid role players, and then Durant's able to elevate his game and make up for some of the offensive void of Westbrook. So, I mean, they've got a great foundation. Absolutely, they miss Westbrook. You know, I don't know if they can survive Memphis without him. I'm virtually certain they can't win the NBA title without Westbrook. But you're right, they've put up a pretty good fight without Russell Westbrook.
On Thursday, Westbrook held his first press conference since the knee surgery. You were there expecting the same old personality, but as you observed in a recent column, the guy who never met a chip he couldn't strap to his shoulder went all Dale Carnegie. Was that a surprise?
Well, I mean, Russell is a great player, but just to be honest, he's sort of surly. Doesn't really like to talk to the media, and it's not just the media. I mean, he just sort of walks around and lives with a chip on his shoulder. Thunder insiders say that's not really who he is. He's really a great guy, but he's playing with an edge. He's playing angry. And he walks in yesterday, and he wasn't that way at all. I mean, he's peaceful. He's smiling. He's charming. We all said, who is this guy? Invasion of the body snatchers, and you know, with and maybe this really is who he was. He was very, very engaging and accommodating and insightful, all the things he never has been with us in the 5 years that we've been following his career.
Well, having endured knee surgery myself, I have to wonder if perhaps it was the medication.
Well, it, you know, I thought of that, and somebody asked him a question. He said, well, the meds were pretty good, but I assume they've worn off. I don't know, but he definitely showed a different side of himself yesterday.
I had not realized that until this recent injury, Westbrook had never missed a game in the regular season or the playoffs in 5 seasons in the league. That's not quite Cal Ripken-esque, but impressive nonetheless.
Well, it is, and especially the way he plays. He plays with abandon. He plays with a fearlessness. He's taken a bunch of nasty falls. And, you know, that's what was so surprising to us the other night when he got hurt against Houston. You know, as soon as he got hurt, he bounced over to the scorer's table and just slammed his fist onto the scorer's table. And then he went out and scored 20 points the rest of the night. And you think, well, same old Westbrook. So that's what made it such stunning news. He says he can't remember ever missing a game anywhere, high school, UCLA, certainly not. But he said he can't remember ever missing a game, period, in his entire life.
Kevin Durant is the biggest star on the team. As you have mentioned, he's averaged 28 points in the regular season and 33 in the postseason. This doesn't suggest that Oklahoma City is better off without Westbrook, does it?
No, not at all. I mean, if you've watched the first few games of Memphis and the last four games against Houston, this offense really had a void, and you could tell. In fact, I would say that Russell Westbrook's value and importance to this team has never been more obvious than since he's been out.
Barry Trammell is a columnist for the Daily Oklahoman. Barry, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thanks a lot.
On Thursday, the Ottawa Senators advanced to the second round of the Stanley Cup playoffs with a 6-1 win over the Montreal Canadiens. The Senators needed just five games to dispatch the Habs. Joining me now to discuss the Senators is Ottawa Citizen sports writer and columnist Ken Warren. Ken, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Years from now, a young hockey fan browsing the results of the 2013 NHL playoffs might conclude that this series was a breeze for the Senators since it only went five games. Would that fan be correct?
No. There's no such thing, I don't think, in any playoff series as a breeze because it's just so physically punishing. Even if a team sweeps a series, they suffer injuries, nagging injuries, all sorts. They're battered and bruised, no question.
All right, since you have brought up physical punishment, I want to talk about Game 3. It featured a hat trick by Ottawa rookie Jean-Gabriel Pageau and 236 penalty minutes, so there must have been some pain involved. Was that hockey at its beautiful best or at its ugly best?
That's a matter of perception, right? The game was over when all of the ugliness and nastiness started, and I think at that point frustrations boil over and you get into a situation where, in Montreal's case, I guess they were trying to send a message for the next game, realizing that that one was over, and you know, Ottawa not wanting to cede anything to them, we were willing to fight back, and that's when things got completely out of hand. And it is, unfortunately, I suppose, a part of playoff hockey when lopsided games are happening.
What we got there was a 5-on-5 brawl, an ugly elbow to the head at one point, and then a Canadiens player deliberately shooting a puck at one of the Senators at the end of the game. Were you surprised that the league didn't impose further penalties after Game 3?
Yes, especially since earlier in the series, if you go all the way back to Game 1, there was a very devastating open ice hit from the Senators' Eric Greiba on Lars Eller of the Montreal Canadiens. And Greiba ended up receiving a two-game suspension from that hit, which didn't sit well with the Senators, who thought it was an overreaction. To settle it down a little bit after the third game, you might have offered another suspension to a Canadiens player.
The Senators went on a five-game losing streak toward the end of the season, and they almost didn't make it to the playoffs. Then after they had advanced, Ottawa team captain Daniel Alfredsson said, "We believe in what we do. We know we're not going to be pretty every night, but we seem to find a way." Is that still the strategy going forward?
That's pretty much how they won that series against Montreal. It was not pretty hockey. It was not up and down the ice, pretty tic-tac-toe passing. It was grinding it out. And the lopsided scores, that's misleading. There's 2-6-1 wins. But, you know, Ottawa's not an explosive offensive team at the best of times, so the number of goals they scored in the series was really quite abnormal. More of the result, I think, of probably suspect goaltending on the other end than anything else.
Ken Warren is a sports writer and columnist for the Ottawa Citizen. Ken, thanks very much.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Last week, snow and rain in Kansas City caused the postponement of back-to-back Royals home games. At the end of April, a Colorado Rockies home game was played in a record low temperature of 23 degrees. But dealing with bad weather is nothing new to some college baseball teams whose seasons start in February. As a result, the playing field hasn't been level between the teams in the North and the traditional powers in the South and the West. Greg Eklund reports.
There were two Cinderellas at last year's College World Series in Omaha, Kent State from Ohio, and Stony Brook from Long Island. They're hardly considered traditional college powers, and in fact, it's rare for two teams from northern climes to get that far. But neither team performed particularly well. After his team bowed out in the second round, Kent State coach Scott Strickland talked about the headlines.
You hear it, you know, Cinderella, you know, sent home. Cinderella sinking like a cinder block, I think, was one that I read. You didn't write that, did you?
No, this reporter can't take credit for that one. But here's one I just came up with. Cinderella prepares for a return to Omaha.
Sights and sounds of California baseball, 45 degrees.
On a gray, chilly February day in San Diego, the Golden Flashes practiced before a four-game series against the University of San Diego Toreros. Teams from the north play many of their early season games on the road against teams from warmer climates. Kent State's first 21 games this season were on the road. Before their February 15th season opener in Wilmington, North Carolina, Strickland's team practiced only two times outside back in Ohio.
One day we probably shouldn't have been. After we were outside for about 30 minutes, I was thinking, why are we out here? But it's tough elements. It's tough going. We've got a field turf field at Kent State. So if it's bearable and there's no snow on the field, we're going to try to get out and at least take some fly balls and some ground balls and do some things like that.
Tonight's game features the Oral Roberts Golden Eagles and your Wichita State Shocker.
The 1989 Wichita State Shockers baseball program took the school's first and so far only NCAA title. Wichita State, better known for its basketball team that plays in nice warm arenas, has struggled and may miss the postseason for the fourth straight year. To Gene Stevenson, who's in his 36th year as the Shockers head coach, the road to Omaha is more challenging than beating the seven other regional winners there.
Oh, it's much harder to get there. Much harder. And for those people that think otherwise, they're a little off the rocker. When we were getting to the College World Series on a regular basis, semi-regular anyway, that we were the only team, you know, in a cold environment that was making it there each year.
Former pitcher Greg Brummett voted the most outstanding player when the Shockers won the College World Series in 1989, recently watched his son, Garrett, make his first start on the mound as a freshman for the Shockers. As a Kansas native and a current baseball coach in the junior college ranks, Greg Brummett knows baseball isn't number one in his home state.
It's not a year-round sport. You know, Kansas is a basketball state. You know, let's be honest with you.
Gene Stevenson would like to change that. And for a long time, he has advocated for a change in the calendar that places baseball closer to when everyone follows it.
It's absolutely ludicrous that we play half of our regular season before basketball and March Madness, Final Four, and all that stuff is over. And no one's thinking baseball, including major leagues, you know, until they start the season. So the only thing that makes sense for baseball to truly be the third major sport in college is to have the season from the 1st of April through August.
But so far, college administrators haven't warmed up to that idea. This season, the Shockers canceled 8 games because of snow and postponed 5 others because of bad weather. Rain, shine, sleet or snow, Wichita State, Kent State, Stony Brook, and other Arctic college squads will try to write new Cinderella stories despite the weather. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund.
Buffalo Bills defensive end Mario Williams went on offense this week. Specifically, he sued his former fiancée, Erin Marzuki, for the return of the $785,000 ring he gave her when they got engaged. According to court records, Mr. Williams is contending that Ms. Marzuki, to whom he also gave an additional $230,000 worth of gifts, quote, never intended to marry the plaintiff and used the relationship as a means to get the plaintiff's money and acquire gifts. If that was the plan, it seems to have worked for Ms. Marzuki, who also allegedly ran up $108,000 on a credit card Mr. Williams gave her in less than a year. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a new book about the prelude to the Athens Olympics by the woman who was in charge. But first, on Wednesday, former Michigan basketball star Chris Webber's 10-year excommunication imposed by the NCAA ended. Excommunication was not the NCAA's term, but it was the word Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman used when she wrote about Chris Webber this week. Rachel Bachman, welcome to Only a Game.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Remind us of what Chris Webber did wrong back in 1993.
Well, the NCAA found him guilty of accepting, over a period of about 5 years, $280,000 that was offered by a Michigan basketball booster. That's in violation of the NCAA's amateurism rules, which say that a player cannot accept anything above tuition, room, and board, with only a few exceptions.
One of Webber's complaints, and it's a complaint he shares with lots of college athletes in the revenue sports, is that he generated a lot of money for Michigan, and he was not compensated for doing so. What kind of money are we talking about?
Well, I've seen some estimates that the Fab Five, which was the recruiting class that he was a part of in that 91-92 first season at Michigan, generated several million dollars, as many as $6 million or more, just in terms of the boost they gave that program from previous years. But they also were part of a larger trend in college sports in which the broadcast rights of games are increasingly valuable, particularly in men's basketball and football.
You've written that as early as next month, a federal judge may change the landscape to which Webber and others have objected. Remind us of Ed O'Bannon versus NCAA and what next month's decision could mean.
Yes, Ed O'Bannon was a basketball player for UCLA around the time that Webber played for Michigan, actually. And O'Bannon noticed some years later that his likeness and number were used in a video game that was licensed by the NCAA, as were the likenesses and numbers of many other college athletes. None of them got any money from that game, and this really irked O'Bannon, and as a result, he decided to sue the NCAA to gain a portion of its revenues. And in fact, he's hoping that this suit will be broadened to include many current and former college athletes who he feels helped generate income, but they didn't get any of it for themselves.
If the O'Bannon case does end up becoming a class action suit, which is what he intends, how do you suppose the NCAA will respond?
Well, that really is the multi-billion-dollar question, isn't it? the reason why the class action status is so important is because it would involve so many more players and many, many more millions of dollars in potential damages to the NCAA. You could see the NCAA either paying out a very valuable settlement, potentially, or who knows, it could be something even more extreme than that would forever alter the way that the NCAA operates.
You have suggested that the current system in which athletes like Chris Webber are not compensated has led to large amounts of money being spent on facilities and coaches. Why have the universities done that?
Well, it's simply because there's a finite number of places where that money can go, right? So what's happening is, as I mentioned earlier, the rights fees for live broadcasts of games are absolutely skyrocketing, in part because, you know, more and more people are watching things on Netflix. And as a result, this has made live sports viewing tremendously popular because people will sit there and watch it as it happens and watch the commercials and subscribe to cable companies. And so that whole package has made the enterprise tremendously valuable.
The NCAA is under fire for all sorts of reasons these days, including fouling up their own investigations in Florida with unethical conduct. I wonder, is the NCAA worried about its own future?
Well, that's difficult to say. They've said very little in detail about the O'Bannon case or sort of its prospects for the case. Of course, publicly, the NCAA is fairly optimistic. But certainly this case, which started in 2009, has gotten much farther than similar initiatives against the NCAA. So I think you have to say it's a serious threat.
Rachel Bachman's article, College Sports and the Giant Albatross, appeared in Wednesday's Wall Street Journal. You can find a link to it at our website, onlyagame.org.
Rachel, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Should Chris Webber have been punished by the NCAA for 10 years? Should athletes be paid to play for their schools? Or should the current system endure? Share your thoughts by visiting our Facebook page, facebook.com/onlyagameradio. That's facebook.com/onlyagameradio. For the first time in the 75-year history of the NCAA, all three divisions in men's basketball played their championship games in one place over the course of one weekend. And by most accounts, it worked out well. That's left NCAA officials with a decision. Do they make the combined championship format permanent or go back to holding the championships in different cities? As Jim Burris from WABE in Atlanta tells us, it's an especially tricky question for Division III.
Here's an apparent oxymoron. A record-setting crowd at Atlanta's Phillips Arena that fills only about one-third the seats. But that's how it worked out when 6,300 fans watched the Crusaders of the University of Mary Hardin Baylor take on the Amherst College Lord Jeffs for the 2013 Division III men's basketball title. The game had all the workings of the nearby Division I championship, televised live on CBS, pep bands, cheerleaders. The unranked Crusaders never enjoyed a lead, but were scrappier against number 2 Amherst than the 87-70 final score reflects.
When you're a kid growing up, the only thing you want to do if you're a basketball player is play in the NBA.
That's Amherst All-American Willie Workman. And at the post-game press conference, it was hard to tell whether he was more excited about a national title or about playing on an NBA court.
That's what I've wanted to do for as long as I can remember. So when I heard that it was going to be played in Atlanta, the championship game, and it was going to be at Phillips Arena, I was overjoyed. We kind of set our minds to it that we were going to get here and play in this arena.
6'1" guard and Lord Jeff's star player Aaron Toomey seemed equally smitten by the venue.
It's incredible. This, like he said, this is what you dream of when you're a little kid out in the driveway. You dream of hitting a big shot, and you think in the NBA, but like this is as close as we're going to get at this point. So this is what it's turned into.
The arena, the crowd, the experience. It all made such an impression on Mary Hardin Baylor head coach Ken DeWeese.
If I can get on my soapbox for a second.
He called on the NCAA to change how it holds Division III championships for good.
If we don't all get together and make this a permanent thing, I think we're slighting our student-athletes. The experience these guys have had, the way the NCAA people and the city of Atlanta have treated us, it is something that each team should have an opportunity to aspire to get to, regardless where the Final Four is. For Division II and Division III, in my opinion, in college basketball, this is the best thing that's ever happened.
Making the change may seem like a no-brainer. This year brought a crowd twice the size of past years, which have averaged about 2,900 fans, according to the NCAA's tally. And there was a spillover effect from the big Division I schools' fans, like John Zenner, who drove from Traverse City to support Michigan in the Division I championship. He couldn't find tickets, so he figured he'd
probably go to the D2, D3 games.
So I'm going to put you on the spot. Who's playing for the D3 championship?
I do not know.
Of the dozen or so Division I fans I talked to, Zenner was the only one planning to attend the lower division games. So Division III's championship might have a ways to go before it enjoys a high-profile status, but you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who didn't agree this year's combined games afforded a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Division III players. But here's the thing. Division III is, well, it's different by design. And that's why Amherst head coach David Hickson was less enthusiastic.
One of the special things about Division III is that the seasons end. And they end a little bit sooner. Kids can play maybe a second sport. Kids have a little bit more time to actually be students and not the athlete part, but students and not just the book student part.
And part of the draw for athletes to Division III schools is that they can be students first. But to line up with the Division I calendar, Amherst and Mary Hardin Baylor had to play 3 extra weeks this season. Amherst's team didn't get a spring break. Dan Dutcher is VP for Division III at the NCAA. He says messing with that balance is a legitimate concern.
We're unique as a division in that we have the shortest playing seasons, the most restrictive numbers of contests. We don't permit redshirting. We don't permit athletics aid. all of those principles, all those legislative standards are designed to try to encourage student athletes to have more time to address their academic needs and to be regular students.
Dutcher says the NCAA is open to a change in how Division III holds its basketball championship, but before that happens, colleges would have to weigh in, and some have. A straw poll found two-thirds of Division III schools opposed to combining championships if it meant a longer playing and practice season. And then there's the practical side of it, and by practical, I mean financial.
The NCAA really doesn't make money on Division III.
This year, Division I chipped in about $250,000 just to bring Division II and III's teams to Atlanta. There's no timeline for a final decision on combining championships, but Dutcher says the NCAA would need 9 to 12 months at minimum to plan for a change. That could mean this year's Division III championship really was a once-in-a-lifetime deal. For Only a Game, I'm Jim Burris in Atlanta.
It may be an exaggeration to say that without Jana Angelopoulos, there would have been no Athens Olympics. Perhaps the 2004 Summer Games would have been possible without her leadership, but maybe not. Joining me in the studio is Jana Angelopoulos, now an ambassador of the Greek state. She served as president of the Greek Bidding and Organizing Committee for the 2004 Games, and she's written a book about that experience and her life titled My Greek Drama, Life, Love, and One Woman's Olympic Effort to Bring Glory to Her Country. Ambassador Angelopoulos, welcome to Only a Game.
Bill, thank you very much for the warm introduction. You can call me Jana. I think it's easier.
Very good. I'm not sure any experience can ever prepare somebody to head a nation's Olympic organizing committee, but tell us a little bit about your background and the experience that made you a good candidate for that job.
I'll start from my father. When asked from his friends that it's a pity that he doesn't have any son, he answered, "I don't need a son. I have Gianna." So that's the way, imagine back in the 1950s, in Greece, a male-dominated society. The second thing that he should warn me, it was, "Jana, you can do whatever you decide in life." And this is the way I went through my life.
You write that in the 90s, when you began working to win the 2004 Games for Athens, quote, "you envisioned a new Greece, a novel Greece." Why was such a vision necessary?
I knew it was around my country a stereotype about lazy Greeks, Greeks that they never perform, that they don't deliver. Actually, you remember that we lost the Centennial Games to Atlanta because Greeks, they were arrogant. We thought that the International Olympic Committee owes us the Games because we have the history. This time, I wanted to show a different Greece, a can-do country who can keep its promises and can deliver it. And we proved that, actually.
Every Olympics is criticized, often legitimately, for displacing people in the name of getting ready for the Games, usually poor people who have perhaps nowhere else to go. And for the sake of the spectacle, this often happens. Did that happen to any extent in Athens?
The thing is that in Athens and in every city that has the Olympics, there is a new once in a life, once in a space of a generation opportunity to create infrastructure that it will help the Olympics, but the most important thing is that they will be there as a legacy. We changed the face of Athens. We added so many needed infrastructure projects, a new airport, a new ring road that connected all areas around the city center. It added three subway lines and excellent sports facilities. And I'm happy that you bring it up. No, the Greek government and governments didn't build on that.
In the years following the Games, there have been articles and photographs depicting derelict facilities and tales of enormous fees for maintaining venues that nobody uses. Did the Greek organizing committee lack a plan for what would happen when the Games were over?
It saddens me. It makes me angry. All this effort, you are right. And this should be an example for other cities who want to organize Olympics or even bid for the Olympics. Yes, it's an excellent idea to add projects in the city. But you have to have a plan how to use them in the everyday life of the city after the games. For not to watch around the globe the white elephants, as you should name them. In Sydney, we have an example. In Beijing, in London even, you know, they start to have a discussion what to do with these empty stadiums. And of course, and Athens as well.
You write at one point, and I'm quoting, "Greek politicians and their cronies in the press would never forgive me my Olympic success." Does that explain why some have said that hosting the games at all helped to create the financial crisis that Greece finds itself in today?
This is so wrong, Bill. I know many people know math, or at least elementary maths. The Greek debt back in 2009 was over $400 billion. The Olympic Games in Athens costed, by the government's reports, around 6 billion euros. Let's do the math. How much of the debt is that? And you know something? They should point the finger to the Olympics for a different reason, because they showed a way that the country changed for good. We could continue that. We could be an example for other nations, but most important, we could really alter our lives. Now we have a crisis, and it's a pity, because Greece could do better. I don't blame the Greek people. I blame the bad leadership that we passed the baton, Bill, to them, the lessons learned from the Olympics, and they dropped it.
Ambassador Jana Angelopoulos is the author of My Greek Drama, Life, Love, and One Woman's Olympic Effort to Bring Glory to Her Country. It's published by Greenleaf Book Group Press. She also serves as vice chairman of the Dean's Council of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Madam Ambassador, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Eton, offering the American Red Cross radio line, a portable solar-powered radio with cell phone charger and flashlight for emergencies or travel. Now at Best Buy. This is NPR.
It's world record time in Stockholm, Sweden, where the highest chair carousel is open for business. The Eclipse, upon which people soar 400 feet into the air, is equipped with 12 swings. Each has a double seat and hangs from an 8-foot-long chain, which is pretty much the scary part, right? Anyway, any couple brave enough to take the ride at 40 miles an hour can see pretty much all there is to see of Stockholm and adjoining areas. More precisely, the carousel affords a fine view of Royal National City Park and the Royal Palace, the Swedish Parliament, and the recently opened ABBA Museum, although you can't actually see inside that or hear the music from 400 feet in the air, so that's okay. There was something. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, rating running rodents. Grossed out? Get over it. They're gerbils. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The Chicago Blackhawks and the Ottawa Senators have punched their tickets for the second round of the NHL playoffs on Thursday, first two teams to do so. So clearly one of those teams will take home the cup, right?
No, well, I think the Blackhawks have a better chance than the Senators do. The Senators made very short work out of Montreal, which kind of surprised me, actually, and short and bloody work, I might add.
Game 3 in the series between the Canadiens and the Senators featured 236 penalty minutes. Did it feature any hockey?
Very little, actually. It was a 4-1 game that ended up at 6-1. Everybody on the ice at one point or another dropped the gloves, and the crowd roared. So I guess they're giving the people what they want.
The Miami Heat's LeBron James may have been the near-unanimous NBA regular season MVP, but Only a Game intern Martin Kessler thinks Stephen Curry of the Golden State Warriors might be giving the king a run for his money in the postseason MVP race. Do you agree with our intern?
Well, Stephen Curry is having a breakout postseason. The problem is he's having a breakout postseason for the Golden State Warriors, who aren't going to be going much further, but he's really been terrific, and he's moved into the elite class in the NBA and just in the series.
Charlie, Kobe Bryant's Lakers got knocked out of the NBA playoffs in the very first round, but he's making news this week anyway. Why is that?
He's fighting with his mother, who's trying to sell off his high school mementos from the early days of his professional career. She claims that he gave her the stuff, and now she's selling it, and he claims he never gave it to her, so now mom and Kobe are in court.
This is the sort of thing that happens to all of us on a much smaller scale. I don't think my mom sold my baseball.
No, I know cards. My mom gave away all my comic books. I know that for a fact. I may not have forgiven her yet.
During a game on Tuesday night, Toronto Blue Jays pitcher J.A. Happ took a line drive to the head. He left the field on a stretcher. Fortunately, it looks like he's going to be okay. But the incident brought up once again the question of whether pitchers ought to be somehow protected on the mound from batted balls. What do you think?
I don't know how you do it. You can't put up a screen. The pitcher is told to keep looking at the plate. He's not supposed to turn away when he throws the ball. This is why unless you're going to find some kind of face shield, or some sort of head covering, which they would wear, which I can't imagine, pitchers actually adopting. This may be part of the game. I don't know what the remediation on this is.
Maybe the theory is like helmets. People once said batters were terribly uncomfortable with helmets, but when you start kids wearing helmets, they grow up, they're used to them.
Well, I'm sure you could have pitchers. I'm sure you could have pitchers wear helmets, but that would not have helped Happ. I mean, he got hit with a line drive, came right back in his face.
All right, when is a home run not a home run? The answer is when, against all the evidence, the umpire says it isn't. That happened on Wednesday night when the Oakland A's were denied a tying run against the Cleveland Indians. Major League Baseball later acknowledged that the umpire had goofed and it should have been called a home run. Is there any way to avoid this sort of thing?
Yeah, Bud Selig can step in and reverse the call. He's got the power to do it. He should just do it.
You don't like the idea of the electronic laser beam around
the entire
stadium?
I like the solution of electronic laser beams for almost everything.
Unless the Queen of England acts soon, there will be no sirs among the coaches in England's premiership next season. Are you in mourning over the retirement of Manchester United's Sir Alex Ferguson?
No, but an awful lot of other people are. I've read several very long columns about what a tragedy this is. I don't know anything about this David Moyes character, but he's stepping into the shoes of a legend, I'm sure.
This week, Cleveland Browns owner Jimmy Haslam apologized to his team's fans. Did he just notice that his team only won 5 games last year?
This is never a good thing when your team wins 5 games and the FBI is investigating you. He's being investigated for fraud inside of the truck stop company that he runs. He runs Pilot Flying J, which if you've driven on any interstate in America, you've seen them.
Even if your team wins like 16 games, it's not good.
It's never good. Never good to have the FBI investigating you, no.
I understand that Detroit Lions wide receiver Titus Young set a record this week. How did he do that? It's not even football season.
Well, Titus had a bad, awful day for himself on Sunday. He got busted for making an illegal left-hand turn and then was arrested for the suspicion that he may have made that left-hand turn because he was a little sockless at the wheel. And he was booked and he issued a citation and they later released. And then at 2 o'clock that afternoon as somebody would say, under the cover of broad daylight, Titus decided to go get his car back. So he climbed the fence at the impound lot, apparently forgetting that the impound lot is run by, the police, and he got arrested again.
Charlie, I am happy to report that the highest paid public employee in the state where both of us reside is not a college football or basketball coach. But the same cannot be said of nearly every other state in the union, if I read this chart correctly.
Yeah.
Help.
There are several. First of all, New Hampshire is a hockey coach, so
yeah,
that's an interesting.
That's
so we'll file that one away, too. Both Dakotas, it's the medical school dean. It's a medical school chancellor here in Massachusetts. The law school dean in Maine. The med school plastic surgeon in Nevada. And the college president in Alaska. And that's it. Everything else is football or basketball coach.
Oh.
And, I mean, yes, they get paid out of the general revenues their sports promote, but still, they are public employees.
And finally, Charlie, 10-year-old Lily Allen.
Sports!
It was a question of whether you were going to shout that before I even began the question. But anyway, Lily Allen, 10 years old, has found herself on the wrong side of the law. What was her crime?
She climbed over the fence to get her car back. No, she didn't climb over the fence to get her car back. That's not true. No, Lily, I know you didn't. Lily chalked herself up a hopscotch grid on the pavement, and the local gendarmerie in Ramsgate, Kent, she was warned by two of the members of the local gendarmerie that she can't do that because it's criminal damage of a public facility. I mean, it is a hopscotch grid, and it's chalk. If it rains in Ramsgate, right?
It rains in England.
It
a good
does
deal,
rain
actually.
In England, right? I didn't miss a memo. It still rains there. This will be gone in a day. Yeah. I don't know what the cops are up to.
They
should come over here and guard the impound lot. Is what they should do.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, among other places. Charlie, thank you very much.
Thanks, Paul.
The Oracle of Omaha encouraged his legions of fans to invest in themselves this week. Followers of Warren Buffett typically hang on the billionaire investor's every word for nuggets of wisdom and financial advice, and at this year's annual shareholders meeting in Omaha, Nebraska, the first annual Invest in Yourself race was no different. Robin Murray has the story.
Okay, the command will be runner set, and then I'll fire the gun. Runner set!
Warren Buffett stood on a platform in front of about 2,000 runners in downtown Omaha last Sunday. Dressed in black runner's gear, Buffett, who will turn 83 this year, warmed up the crowd with a couple of jokes, some dance moves, and a bit of jogging in place.
I'd like to be out there running with you, ha ha ha. Next year I'll be ready for you. I'm not quite tuned up yet. But I got my shoes on. I'm ready to go.
Buffett's Invest in Yourself 5K was the first event of any athletic kind at this annual weekend that's typically filled with financial advice and indulgence in Nebraska's famous steaks and Dairy Queen soft serve. Dairy Queen is a subsidiary, along with dozens of other companies, of Buffett's massive investing firm Berkshire Hathaway. Buffett's investing success has made him one of the richest men in the world and a sought-after financial whiz whose shareholders, followers, and fans eat up his words like Oreo blizzards.
They do. You know, he tweeted the first time either not yesterday, the day before, and he got something like 150,000 followers in the first hour or some crazy number.
John Correa is an organizer with running gear giant Brooks Sports, another subsidiary of Berkshire and sponsor of the 5K. The day before the race, Correa handed out bibs and bags of goodies to shareholders who had registered to run.
Are you guys registered to do the 5K tomorrow?
No.
No? No, okay.
Which not everyone had done, but many others had, including Carol Williams of Bellevue, a neighboring city of Omaha.
I'm happy to see somebody that everybody looks up to encourage exercise because it can make such a difference.
Williams says she started running last year and she can already feel the improvement in her health. And she says she's happy to be taking advice from somebody like Buffett.
He's got a lot of wisdom. I mean, look at where he is. And if I could just find some of his secrets, I'd be a lot better off than I am today.
Some of those secrets might seem to conflict with a healthy lifestyle. Buffett spent some time on Saturday with his partner, Charlie Munger, chatting with shareholders and snacking on a couple of his favorite treats and, as it happens, his favorite investments, See's Candies and Coca-Cola. But that didn't deter Maggie Mattson, who traveled to Omaha from Minneapolis for the meeting and the race.
Obviously, he's very successful, and he's come this far. And even, you know, snacking on peanut brittle and drinking Diet Cokes, you know, all day today. I mean, he's really plugging along. And I think, yeah, I love reading his words of wisdom about, you know, investing, financial, big picture, women in business. I really love reading about that. But I think it means something else to say, you know, look at your health. You know, look at everything else that's happening outside of just the financial health.
Matt Larson, who traveled with her, agreed.
We think about investing as a financial habit and to do it wisely, and that helps us take care of ourselves in other ways. But part of a healthy lifestyle is, I mean, it's the same principles as financial investing and eating healthy and exercising, and hopefully we all get to be Warren and Charlie's ages someday. It's something we'd like to do anyway, but really cool and to be able to do it here and with that banner.
And I'm just hoping to get a high five from Warren Buffett at the finish line. So that's my motivation.
High five would be really, that wasn't my idea, but I like that. Now I'm dreaming about it.
The next day, Buffett did hand out some high fives as the runners hit the road. He also waited at the finish line to award crystal trophies and pose for photographs with the winners.
Well, thanks all for coming, and This is just the start. We'll be doing this for decades to come, and I'll be here every time.
After the race, shareholders headed to Borsheim's, a luxury jewelry store and subsidiary, for brunch. On the menu, a light, healthy meal of fruit and quiche, and a heavy dose of salesmanship. Buffett himself manned the store, handing out discounts and selling millions of dollars in diamonds and jewels in just a couple of hours. For Only a Game, I'm Robin Murray.
To see Robin Murray's photos of Warren Buffett and his footloose financial types, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Over the past 20 years, we've brought you stories about lots and lots of equine athletes. Exotica was my favorite. The trainer of the year told me to bet on her at Saratoga, and she balked at the gate and got scratched. That was in the early days of Only a Game. We've covered a story or two about canine athletes as well. After all, who can resist the cuteness of the puppy bowl? But as far as I know, we've never chatted about athletes of the gerbil variety, and that's about to change. Libby Hanna, president of the American Gerbil Society, joins me on the line. Ms. Hanna, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you so much for having me. I love the show. I'm happy to be on it.
Well, thank you. I have to admit that before this moment, I was not aware of gerbil showing and gerbil agility as sports. How long has this been going on?
Well, gerbil showing has been going on at least for about 10 years. This was actually our 12th annual New England show.
Mm-hmm.
And gerbil agility is a little bit newer. That's something we actually spotted that, I think, on an internet video. There was a gerbil named Binky, who I believe maybe lived in Germany. And she got a very popular video of her running around the room and jumping over little fences. And that was pretty adorable, and several of our members got interested. It's still at the demonstration level, kind of like in the Olympics. People are still working on training techniques, so we don't have an official competition for agility yet, but I suspect it could be part of the future.
So gerbil showing, I guess, is similar to the Westminster Dog Show, except if a real dog showed up, there'd be real problems, I would guess. But you've compared the ideal gerbil to the ideal human athlete. Let's start with the males. What type of athlete are you looking for there?
So when you judge a male gerbil, a helpful human model to have in mind is a football player. When I judge, I use a couple of icons from my youth. I think about sort of on a spectrum, Walter Payton on one end, you know, extremely athletic, obviously a very strong man, not a huge man, but fast and agile, strong and powerful. And then on the other end of the spectrum, I remember William Refrigerator Perry. He's just huge. Huge.
I wonder how he would feel about being an iconic figure in the world of gerbil showing.
I don't know. He'd probably have sort of a mixed reaction. Mm-hmm. I suspect he'd be glad to be remembered. Maybe the comparison, I don't know whether he'd see the humor in it or not. I hope he would.
I hope so as well. What about the females? I assume you don't want them to remind you of William Refrigerator Perry.
No, definitely not. The model that we suggest to people is a figure skater or perhaps a gymnast. And I usually use, in spite of her somewhat unfortunate ending in sports, I use Tanya Harding. And if you think back to Tanya and Nancy, Nancy was the more perhaps elegant and a little willowy of the two. Tanya, just a little bit bigger, you know.
And more felonious.
Yes, that's right. As far as temperament goes, which is another important part of gerbil showing, we don't keep those sorts of figures in mind at all. We're looking for friendly, curious, happy animals. In a close competition, many a gerbil has edged his or her way into first place by running up the judge's arm and sitting on her shoulder or something like that.
Now, one of your sport's major events was held last weekend in New England, as I understand it. It attracted dozens of competitors from as far away as Ohio, and I'm sure everyone who's still listening is dying to know who won.
Oh, yeah. The overall breed competition was won by a gray agouti male gerbil by the name of Kanai. and he belongs to Joe Kelly of Lexington, Kentucky. The female winner, which we call best opposite sex, was actually my gerbil, Sorka, who is a Siamese female, and she was about 4 months old.
And you weren't embarrassed as president of the American Gerbil Society to also be a winner?
No, I think I've had a long enough history with the AGS of not being a winner that they figure I came by it honestly.
Libby Hanna is, in fact, the president of the American Gerbil Society. Libby, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for calling.
Ooh, look at all that chewed up cardboard. Ooh, what to do with all that cardboard. Eleanor Gerbil, gnawing away at the edge of another page. Alone in her cage, look at her working, moving her castles of paper from here to there. Why does she care?
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Alex Smith at KCUR in Kansas City. Our intern is Martin Kessler, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word this week comes from Libby Hanna, president of the American Gerbil Society.
I've had rats, too, now that I remember, so don't want to discredit the rats.
Well, there's no danger of that happening, Libby. All the rats I've known have pretty much discredited themselves. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Gerbil, gerbil, rearrange, make everything just so. What she thinks she's going to change, only she can know. Ooh, look at all that chewed up cardboard.
Support comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. The SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence, at thescanfoundation.org. And the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to a vigorous presence for poetry in American culture, poetryfoundation.org. This is NPR.